Welcome to Between the Biotech Waves. I'm your host, Nesson Birmingham. Today gives me great pleasure to welcome John Hoffman, Managing Director of Credit Suisse and Head of Healthcare Equity Capital Markets. John has nearly two decades of experience on Wall Street supporting the biotech industry. Welcome, John. Today I have John Hoffman with me. John, it's great to take the time to talk to you. It would be, if you don't mind taking the first minute or two just to talk about, you know, your historical experience, your sort of role at Credit Suisse, and as we kind of dig into the current structure of the market, sort of general perspective on what we're seeing in the market today.
That sounds great, Nesson. You've got, you're doing these at a really topical time, as we were kidding before the call. There's maybe not a lot of deal activity, but certainly a lot of conversations happening, and we're working real hard to make sure that companies are thinking about the capital markets on a proactive, in a proactive manner, because it's clearly a really discerning environment. On my background, so I head up the healthcare ECM effort at Credit Suisse. We've got a broad team focused on the effort. Biotech specifically takes up a lot of our time, just given the number of companies that exist and the financing need of those companies. So it's where I built my career. I've been doing this for about 15 years or so, which I think is the time point at which you can just stop dating yourself, because you've seen a couple of market cycles. At that point, I started out at a couple of the boutiques focused on healthcare, came over to Credit Suisse about 10 years ago at this point. I was focused on the West Coast first, so we're based out in San Francisco, and had a really fun experience just tripping over companies out there. It's hard to even just walk down the street without meeting a new company that's got a great idea, and then was asked 5 years ago to come back and head up the effort from the East Coast. So it's a pretty straightforward background, always focused on capital markets, always focused in healthcare. And hopefully that gives you a little bit of that, my background, and can offer some perspective that lasts at least a couple of market cycles at this point, through the good times and the bad.
Well, that's great. And, you know, thank you for taking the time today. When you think about the last few years, there must be an element for you that, you know, of just being able to kick back. It's the summer and say, okay, market's quiet. It's been a crazy, 2-3 year cycle for you. So just being able to go home, have dinner on time with your family, and look at the summer ahead, there must be some element of it that there's a little bit of relief, right? But market, you know, you look at it, XBI, we're 46% down year to date. Really no major offerings as we look at the marketplace within healthcare. Can you frame it out for us how you view the market over the market dynamic over the last 2 to 3 years, and put that in context with some of the other cycles that you've seen over your career?
Yeah, no, happy to. It's been, as you said, it's nice to get home and have dinner with the family, but I got to admit, it's kind of always back to work and trying to think of creative solutions for clients at the moment, because it's, while it's maybe the non-traditional forms of financing haven't been necessarily open, there's a whole cottage industry that's building around these really unique and creative ways to access capital in a more discerning environment, which makes my job, honestly, a little bit more fun during these times, which is maybe counterintuitive, but nonetheless, we'll probably cover that in a little bit further on in the conversation. Based on what we've seen over the past number of years, we obviously had just an incredible level of activity over kind of the 2020-2019 type time frame, where there was so much liquidity in the system and so many different ways to finance companies. You saw this just broad-based re-equitization trade happen across almost every different subsector of the economy, whether it was tech, industrials, biotech for sure. The equity trade was pronounced, and there were a number of different forcing functions that caused people to focus on equity as an asset class, as a efficient form of capital, even though it can be expensive in that it's permanent. And when you saw, I think, a number of different potential market moving events or things that were perceived to be headwinds, whether it be the uncertainty around the election or obviously COVID, just the concept of building up a permanent capital base to grow your business or to develop a new technology, or to position yourself offensively to take advantage of different M&A opportunities, that was just a psychology that permeated both the consumers of capital, so on the corporate side, but it was very much a investment theme that that the buy side, I think, bought into as well. So that, I think, was just a backdrop that we hadn't really seen, at least in my career, where there was a preference for equity irrespective of what the company's a company phenotype was. And so that was a kind of a top-down driver of, I think, activity within the broader ecosystem. And that almost had this flywheel effect of what it allowed and enabled biotech companies to do. When smaller companies, those with novel technologies, started to emerge and had access to what was at one point perceived to be almost near limitless amounts of capital, we really started to see companies push the boundaries of scientific exploration, of what they were willing to do, the types of risks that they were able to take on, which catapulted the life sciences sector, in my view, to a place where it had not been historically. So we went from talking about only things that were potentially best in class, maybe reformulations or things that were not really that exciting, a bit incremental in nature, to these real step function changes in scientific discovery. And I can't speak to some of the kind of the rigor that needs to happen to go behind assessing all of those different technological advancements, but it's the sense that it was accruing in such a dramatic fashion was palpable. So that cycle, that I think was definitionally what was really different about this current market cycle, where just the risk appetite to fund earlier stage programs in the public markets was very different than what we saw historically. As a result, you saw public equities with companies that had extended timelines, but also big vision. So with this push-pull dynamic of, we don't look very much like we did, or the market doesn't look very much like it did in prior windows, but the excitement and the justification for why those companies were able to get out was a sellable theme because the market opportunity was just so large. So hopefully that paints a little bit of the dynamic of what the macro perspective was, and kind of happy to go into more detail around either that or some of the micro factors that impacted on how we got to where we are today, which is obviously a very different place and something that's more discerning.
That would be great. Moving into all this capital flowed into the biotech sector, totally agree. You have these inflection points of great science because capital comes in, people are willing to take more risk, X projects in place, sort of pushing the boundaries. But now we've reset. Multiple companies announcing restructurings, headcount reductions, you know, anywhere from 25 to 75%. What really has catalyzed that and these sort of drops as we look at the overall market and frankly, market sentiment to biotech from an investor perspective?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing now is it's clearly a byproduct of all the capital that came into the sector and funded these great ideas. What probably didn't keep pace as new companies were being formed and these disruptive ideas were being funded was a way to benchmark this clinical progress in a manner that was had read through across all of these companies. So, and maybe said differently, not having standardized preclinical models or not having the capability to really understand, will this disruptive technology be the winner versus this other disruptive technology that maybe are doing things similarly. So there was, I think, just a point in time where the excitement overwhelmed the lack or the ability to price some of these different fundamental factors that investors had gotten excited about. And now everybody's in a little bit of a dynamic of, do I really know what I own currently? Is it something that I can fully assess both the opportunities, but now importantly, the risks in a capital constrained environment where it's hard to make that judgment around technology platforms and who's maybe a winner over time when the answer by definition in biotech is always a bit delayed because of just clinical development timelines. And the proof is always in the pudding. It's what you actually deliver to patients at the end of the day and what response rates look like or what clinical benefit outcomes ultimately track towards. So we've got this issue where it's undoubted, undoubted belief that science has gotten better, but the ability to understand and price that risk and differentials between companies is just not well defined. So that's a real friction point, I think, that exists in the industry. And unfortunately, the byproduct of that now is you've got to see some rationalization. And sometimes it feels like it's a little bit of a random walk as to why some companies are succeeding and others are failing. As we all know within biotech, sometimes good fortune has to be met with all the scientific progress that we've made to drive towards a beneficial outcome for patients at the end of the day. But I think that real friction point that exists right now is just a lack of an inability to fully diligence, fully understand all these different technology platforms that exist.
But how's it changed? Like their ability to value or determine risk here, how has that changed versus 2 years ago? I mean, these companies, arguably the fundamentals of the companies have improved both as you look at the data that's come through from them, the management teams from an experience standpoint, and the augmentation or continued support of them by people being brought in, same on boards. What's changed from risk metric? It feels that it's less of a fundamental, it's more of a technical, market technical and economic technical than actual sector fundamental.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, if there's anything fundamental that's changed that investors need to price now that is they didn't have to price, maybe it wasn't 2 years ago, but it was certainly 5 to 7 years ago, was the fact that to get to these answers around which technology may be the next disruptor, it's just time, because we've accepted earlier stage companies into the public markets and long duration assets in volatile macro backdrops obviously have a challenging time proving their value inflection points or reaching them in a linear way, because there's clearly a bunch of noise in the system that you have to work through just based on where interest rates are and how people value terminal value, et cetera. So I think that's kind of one of the factors. I would fully agree that science has gotten better, management teams have gotten, are clearly more well equipped to handle the market. There is a contingent of folk within the market that have not necessarily lived through this type of cycle. So I think that clearly impacts psychology. And there's also some, I think, dynamics on the technical side, as you mentioned, that have created some headwinds that we have to deal with. Very practically speaking, I think that we saw tremendous inflows into biotech equity funds. That changes the mentality about what a biotech manager needs to think about as they deploy capital. So it's no longer being able to be as nimble as maybe people once were historically and find unique opportunities. But when you're definitionally needing to write bigger checks into perhaps higher risk opportunities, that creates one type of technical dynamic that is different versus other periods of time. There's other issues at play as well. As you think through some of the M&A market dynamics, you'd hear many of my M&A partners just talk about how biotech companies or the large biotech or the large most notable buyers of assets feel like they can be paid to wait in this market. So there's not necessarily that forcing function and predictability of when M&A may happen, which is also another structural headwind, as many of the investors in the sector underwrite towards those types of outcomes, at least for a portion of the companies that exist in the public markets. So there's clearly some of these technical factors at play that overwhelm fundamentals. There's also this issue, which I think is probably one of the more pronounced ones, of there are so many companies outstanding and so few people that can actually technically evaluate them. There's just a bottleneck between that dynamic and the funnel of opportunities versus the number of capital providers that have the bandwidth to assess them. That's another technical headwind. So I would agree, fundamentals have gotten better, but technicals can sometimes overwhelm those in the short term.
So I'm a biotech CEO. I am publicly listed. I'm sitting on a balance sheet that may have, let's say, 12 to 18 months of cash. I've reduced headcount. I've reduced overall burn. I kind of eked it out over 12 to 18 months, which sounds like, you know, I think based on some of the reports out there, maybe about 40% of the public biotech companies today. What do I do? Like, looking at it from an ECM perspective, what is it you'd advise a CEO in that situation to do?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different avenues. I think one of the natural inclinations within this sector, which I think against the reality of where there's so many different opportunities, is the wrong inclination, is to take that scenario and think about an investor targeting exercise, which is so core to a company's success and how they chart their path forward and rely on the equity markets. And as a result of that targeting exercise, target everybody. They kind of get these big lists of who owns the peers, who's been active in the space, and you come up with this broad spectrum of investors, and it looks like a very long list. And you spend your time trying to build that big, big net of people that you can go after to target for capital and to tell your story, when I think the exact opposite strategy is the right type of one to deploy in that type of situation. Focus on who you think are the most actionable targets, devote the time, embolden them to make a call, to make a bet in a market where you're naturally being a contrarian at the moment, because everything is being challenged, and get equip them to effectively price the risk and price the upside appropriately where you're not necessarily trying to be all things to all people, but focusing in on those that are the most actionable targets in a way that fully helps them understand the story. That sounds really simple, but the number of discussions that we have around who's the incremental capital provider base, when the real question should be, are you spending the appropriate amount of time and giving the appropriate amount of information to those people most likely to help support you in your capital raising efforts, is, I think, the right question to be asking. The other things that I think companies should be doing and being really thoughtful around is this idea of creative financing structures. So I think we oftentimes think about within biotech, there's only one way of financing, and it's the equity market, and you kind of live and die through traditional executions and execution formats in the equity universe. And if your data readout happens to coincide with a Fed meeting that's going in a way that the market isn't hoping that it goes, then all of a sudden you're really in a jam because you don't have a financing window. There's alternative products. There's lots of focus on the sector, lots of different capital providers that think non-traditionally about different forms of financing. We're spending a lot of time talking to companies about in which situations those forms of financing, whether it be trial financing or royalty monetizations or some other creative forms, make sense for a particular company. That's not a panacea. It doesn't make always sense for every company. And like I said at the outset, there was a re-equitization trade for a reason. But finding that incremental dollar for a unique form of financing has outsized impact because you're not relying on the equity market, where most of companies need to be reliant on. And then the last thing I would encourage companies to do is to think really holistically around additional forms of financing outside of just alternative products and execution strategies. There's a really strong appetite amongst an emerging class of mid-cap biotech companies and pharma companies that have a desire to move forward on the risk spectrum, to take advantage of the market that we're in right now and partner with exciting companies that are being overwhelmed by a capital need. So if there's a second program or a first program where you can do a geographic rights deal, or on your second program, something interesting, there's a whole set of potential buyers in that market that we also spend a lot of time with thinking through actionable ideas on the small and mid-cap side.
So picking one point on, I want to come back to the sort of BD M&A side of the equation, but picking back up on the non-traditional forms of financing, are there areas we'd seen historically, things like royalties coming up, right? People effectively willing to back single programs through a certain inflection point, and then the company had the option to buy back. Are there new sort of flavors that you're seeing starting to come out into the market, or people are actually out talking about that is starting to gain some traction there, or is it it's the same as what we've historically seen?
No, I think there's always new forms, and some of these are taking some time to build interest in and around. And this is a little bit of what we kind of position the companies that we're pursuing business from is our secret sauce, to try to figure out unique ways to help companies finance. I'd say that there are some traditional forms. You think about convertible bonds, for instance, which you need to be really cognizant of what the leverage profile is coming out of those types of transactions, and making sure that if you're an earlier stage company, effectively structuring those to the best of your ability as pre-funded equity and not something that's going to leave a large residual, highly levered company that ultimately where the financing instrument becomes self-defeating. So some puts and takes there, but that's clearly a potential product where you can get paid for volatility. You can get paid for scarcity value of those types of companies within that particular product class. We're having some really interesting discussions with companies around other types of monetization events for assets that are being overlooked on their balance sheets or potential future assets. One, for instance, is think of through a scenario where there's a company that's got a rare pediatric designation and potentially could do an early sale of a PRV. So something that's not granted, but clearly there's an expected value for that type of asset. And there should be someone that's willing to underwrite what that future value is. And if there's a differential between what the market is giving you implied in your market cap for that versus what that buyer is willing to pay and the POS that they're willing to assign to it, there should be some type of middle ground there where that provides a non-equity market solution to a financing need. So different flavors. Those are two. There's lots of others behind that that you can explore, but hopefully that gives you a little bit of the contours of the things that we're thinking through.
And given valuations, is there a psychological cap as people look at overall enterprise value ascribed to a company with respect to a transaction? So for example, you look at M&As, and albeit very few, right, within the group of biotechs that IPO'd of the last class, right? You look at the multiple on the value of trading, right? So the PPS, multiple on the PPS at the point where the transaction's announced. And that is below effectively what you're seeing for IPO value or enterprise value that was ascribed to the company at that point in time. It feels like these depressed values, there is huge opportunity, but also for the companies themselves, it really does mean that it feels like they've got a cap now that's kind of hanging over them as you think about the valuation or value that you can ascribe to the assets that you have.
Yeah, I think that's always a debate that we get into, and particularly in times where you feel like the other side of a potential trade may be being opportunistic. At the end of the day, though, I think we're kind of in such a dislocated state that the more grounded boards, the more in my view, well-managed companies look through the near-term dilutive impact of any type of financing that happens at a depressed level, realizing that cash on the balance sheet is the single most important way you can differentiate yourself as a public equity at the moment. And it may be the least dilutive thing that you do. If you raise capital, you see the stock re-rate, and you're just held in a different category into your company where the rest of the market is struggling with that dynamic. So it is certainly something that does tap interest on the corporate side, because you look at that number of the dilution that you have to take in at a price that may be below your IPO price. But I think as we've looked through the market over the past handful of weeks and months here, and the correction has been so severe that's honestly been a part of the conversation that maybe we were having a couple of months ago, but is no longer a real topical part of our discussion. In my experience so far, most boards are now of the mindset of prioritized programs and how you're spending in R&D dollars. And if that means that you need to bring in more capital, we'll do the right size deal, even if it means it comes at what we think is the wrong price, but if we're partnering with the right people, we'll earn back that price in spades over time. There's one M&A deal that, this is a little bit of an outside looking in perspective, but I think that the market overlooked the significance of it, which was the Turning Point deal coming out of ASCO, where you saw what's perceived to be a very high quality company. I don't think anybody could argue that. It was multi-billion dollar market cap over recent IPO class. Trading at a level that was clearly depressed from where they had traded from, but transacting at a level that was also at a discount to what their 52-week high was, which we all know is a psychological barrier that some boards think through of, can you transact below that price? I actually think that was a really important psychological pivot point potentially for the biotech market to see a really well-managed company that was perceived to be quite strong transact with the price that it did. That's a positive development in my view for just the level-headedness that I think many management teams and boards are exhibiting at the moment.
But even for that, I mean, Turning Point, you're right. So Turning Point, great example, right? But in 2021, around February, it was trading up at 133, 134 at the peak. And now you're talking about it maxing out at 70, 74, 36 today. It's we're looking out for the investors that kind of stepped in those points. It's still it feels like it's tough medicine, you know, to see these sort of drops in the valuations and the implications across there. Where you know, arguably that's a successful outcome. Obviously, you also saw a great one for Biohaven, right, with their acquisition. Checkmate, very different, right? Not what you would hope for a company. At the end of the day, though, the programs, there's an element of, if you're dead as a company, your programs are dead. If you survive and you find a way to do it, you know, the programs continue on. And to your point, it's almost like put your head down, get yourself through the next two, three years or 2 years. I think we should talk about duration of market, but let's say next 2 years, And then hopefully when rebound comes in, you've got the data, you've got the support, you continue to move the company forward and start to reach these peaks again or get up back up towards them. It almost feels like watching Survivor somewhat. And I don't mean to be flippant, but it kind of does feel like it's like, you know, you've got to survive it and make it through, you know, or that other one, Alone, you know, where they drop you off and you just got to survive and make it through. And you don't know what day is the final day, but you've just got to get yourself through it. M&A, you know, a lot of discussions about M&A. We always hear, right, people standing up and saying, okay, M&A is just around, the wave of M&A is just around the corner. You know, everybody is sitting on, from a large biotech and pharma standpoint, you know, healthy balance sheets, varies by company, but generally healthy. No one really doing very much. Why is that? And as you think about it from a generalist and specialist investor standpoint, should they not be flooding back into the market in the hopes that actually we're going to see the sort of inflection point of M&A or overall BD really kind of moving through the sector?
Yeah, no, it's I'm going to speak through the lens and with a little bit of a mouthpiece for my M&A partners, because I don't spend all my time there, but it's hard to have a view on the equity market in biotech and the company's alternative set up. You don't have a little bit of a sense of what's going on in M&A and how that option may compare. You know, I think the interesting dynamic, and I think many M&A practitioners would agree with this, that's happening right now is you talk to the BD groups within the larger organizations and everybody looks at the valuations that compared to where they were, and you can start to make the math work where that was almost a near impossibility 12 to 18 months ago, and you really had to underwrite things that were being priced in from a platform perspective where you didn't have great line of sight as to whether or not they would actually play through. Now you're at a point where asset value is starting to be justified by current market cap, even inclusive of a premium that you have to put on top of it, which is probably a fairly rich premium to get companies to act just based on the disconnect from where they were historically trading not too long ago. So you're seeing that level of interest amongst the BD groups, but the dynamic that hasn't changed is internally at all of these organizations, you still need a deal champion. Many times it's on the clinical side. So even if mathematically it makes sense, you've got to convince the team scientifically, and that will always be the guiding principle of these organizations, even at the expense of cost and the incremental dollar it may take to transact. You've got to have that internal champion throughout the organization that's advocating for a particular transaction. So in my view, the technicals are favorable for sure. You've got patent cliffs coming up. That's been a story that we've talked about for years. You've got really healthy cash balances, et cetera. The thing that I think is overlooked and not necessarily discussed as frequently as it should be as to why M&A isn't happening is there's different capital allocation policies and thought processes that happen within these larger organizations. And it almost makes sense at sometimes why in more robust market environments where you can argue things maybe a little toppy from a valuation perspective that you see M&A happen. Because at that same time that large pharma is looking at an M&A transaction, they're looking at other uses for their capital, oftentimes, which is a share buyback or things that are more internally focused. When you look at a large pharma that's trading at 20 times PE at a level that it maybe it's hard to make the math work from a share buyback perspective, that that's a great use of capital when you can go buy growth and buy something that's earlier stage that can fuel your, take your out year financial forward numbers, that I think becomes a more compelling argument. But the same is true in a down market where you've got depressed multiples on the large biotech and pharma side. I'm sure that they're running the math internally around capital allocation strategies and having to contend with the fact that just buying back your own shares may be a higher ROI investment if you're purely looking at it from a straight corporate finance perspective. So it's not as simple as just looking at where the XBI is trading and saying, okay, now's the moment in time that it makes sense to be opportunistic. As in all things within biotech, there's lots of complexities that go behind the decision making with respect to either financing or M&A.
Well, I think that this also raises the question about certainty versus risk. And the last class of biotech IPOs feels like they were certainly earlier in their evolution. So higher risk, you know, preclinical in many cases, in some cases pre-DC. So as you think about, you know, the risk profile and timeline to commercialization, you've got an extended timeline, increased risk, and valuations that, you know, arguably remain on the heady side when you look at expectations, both from an investor and management team standpoint. So I'm sure within a corporate structure, it becomes a far more difficult discussion to take place as you think about allocating capital into that. So it will be interesting to see. Investors in general. Okay, so sitting ECM, head of healthcare ECM, talking to investors all the time. What is their sentiment right now? You know, we're hearing obviously from a lot of the PMs within a number of funds about how they're thinking about asset allocation today, how they're thinking about supporting current positions. What are you hearing? And what are you looking at as you think about the second half of this year? Do you think that this is going to go on through 22 into 23? And obviously, as we look at the inflation numbers and people talking more about a recession and real bear territory now, kind of map out where all of this is going to and what the sort of psychology or sentiment out there is today as you talk to some of the managers.
Yeah, no, I think when we talk to investors, there's an invitation to show them lots of different alternatives and products and unique ideas, because I think there is this overtone of, yes, it's been a painful downdraft, but it also presents an incredibly compelling opportunity for many of them, an opportunity that probably hasn't existed within their investing life cycle. So it's kind of this unique push and pull where, of course, they're feeling the pains of having seen this big downdraft and needing to prepare for that, which I think is evidenced in the fact that you need to think through reserving capital for some of your existing positions, making sure that you're retaining your own talent, making sure that your companies are retaining their own talent, and just asking the types of questions that you don't need to ask in a more permissive market environment. But at the same time, there's a level of almost kind of optimism around the type of returns that can be generated if we can just work through the current dislocation that we see. I think what most investors are looking for at the moment is this concept of, we need to have a durable bottom. So this violently flat market that we're in, where it's, you know, every day you're not sure if you're going to be up 3 or down 3 or up 7% or down 7%. It's just this psychology of, we need to find a bottom, we need to find a point of rationalization, and we can build from there. So some of the signs that we're looking for are that durable bottom dynamic. I think we've tested the current levels a few times now, so hopefully we're approaching that. Based on some of the math that we run, I think that we are approaching that point of rationality. One statistic that we keep track of is trying to assess how much platform credit in the XBI as a whole is ascribed to every company that comprises the aggregate market cap of the XBI. At the market peak, we were tracking almost towards 2/3 to 3/4, somewhere in that zone. Now we're down to around 1/3, which it's hard to frame how that compares to prior periods. There's lots of noise in the data and lots of different assumptions that you need to make, but that just feels like a much more rational place to be. So hopefully that type of intrinsic support is coupled with some of the technical issues that were headwinds that we talked about abating, and we get to this point where we can make the argument we're at a durable bottom, and then it becomes around, well, where did the incremental dollar come from? And how do I think that from a return on invested capital perspective? So I think that's incredibly important. We're seeing, I think, a lot of companies that are trying to do what you would do in this type of climate right now, which is rein in expenses and talk about what types of capital need you have to get to your next clinical inflection point. And we'll see a number test the market in the back half of the year, where I'm hopeful we're actually going to be met with a fairly receptive audience. In the background right now, there's a number of different well-funded biotech investors that are raising opportunities funds and things that will position the sector to have access to capital come the back half of the year. So even if the market doesn't necessarily trade more positively into year end, which it's probably hard to argue that it will, if we can find a durable bottom, if those investors are successful in raising that new capital, where by definition they'll have lower high watermarks than what some of their existing funds are sitting at, I think we could see a heightened level of activity. It won't be the most attractive cost of capital that companies raise capital at, but I do think that they will have sufficient access to capital. And not everybody, obviously. There'll be a selection bias in the highest quality companies. Will obviously command the most amount of attention, but I think we'll be in a very different place than we are right now.
So what are the indicators, again, back to CEO of publicly listed company, right? Looking at the market, realize I need to raise capital. Should I do it now? Should I wait a month? Should I wait till, you know, we get post Labor Day, right? People rest, become more positive, more exposure to the sun, you know, come back in, they're rejuvenated, they're ready to go. And they're like, okay, I haven't been doing much over for the last couple of months. I want to actually start working again and putting capital to work. What is the indicator I should be looking for that turns around and says to me, okay, team, let's go. It's good to go. This is a good indicator.
So I think I probably change my answer every day, but I knew this question was coming, so I tried to think of one in advance. I think from a technical perspective, what I would be looking for is biotech as a sector having more limited correlation with the broader equity market. Right now, everything is a washout, right? Unless you're in the energy sector, you're kind of on your heels, and there isn't great access to capital for any company at the moment, which by definition really shouldn't happen for biotech, right? It should be this defensive sector that doesn't really always need to trade in line with the broader market. Of course, when interest rates re-rate and you have to reassess terminal value, there's going to be an impact of broader macro factors on biotech. But once that's through the system, the sector should trade on its own merits, right? It should be able to produce uncorrelated returns that are disconnected from the macroeconomic backdrop. If we see that, I take that as a very positive sign, because then biotech becomes what it was historically, which was an asset class unto itself. Even though it was mostly about equities, it was biotech equities that I think investors that were giving fund managers capital thought of as a different pool of capital or something that complemented their existing portfolio. That I think will be a really, really important technical factor that, in my view, would put us into a different kind of mindset and hopefully provide a favorable tailwind, or at least proof that there are favorable tailwinds on the way. The other that's a little bit more fundamental and specific to each company is, I think we're going to move into an environment where you see people want to hunker down and own what they know best when they are ready to deploy capital. And so instead of taking this approach where the investment psychology had become anchored around momentum investing and capital markets transactions and things that produce near-term returns, investors are shifting the pendulum back to, I'm pricing clinical risk, I'm pricing catalysts, and the type of return that I can earn on the back of those catalysts. You'll hear from your existing base and from new investors whether you're the type of company that meets their threshold, their criteria, and where they're looking to deploy capital. If you're hearing that level of reverse inquiry and you think it's actionable, I think that's also the backdrop that obviously you want to think about perhaps formalizing the process. So it's partially this technical backdrop and looking through some of the broader statistics to see if you can get that lack of correlation proof point. And then as well as just listening to investors, because they're going to, I think, be very transparent to the companies that they want to own around what they think the right balance sheet looks like and whether or not they'll be part of the solution if there's a problem to be solved.
Are there things that as a company you should be doing as you think about that communication? You know, one of the areas that I was talking to an analyst about was the noise in the system right now seems to be pretty high. You mentioned ASCO. You've got some data, obviously, that came out from ASCO around CAR-Ts and the potential implications or applications there expanded beyond current set opportunity. You know, that sort of catapults somewhat an understanding from an investor standpoint around that area. But generally speaking, are there things the company should be proactively doing to actually increase their voice or increase their position above the noise that's actually out there and to be heard in today's market? Or is it just actually, you know what, don't draw attention to yourself, sit tight, hold and just wait?
Yeah, no, I think every story is different, because every company has got a different positioning and timeline to data, et cetera. I think for those where maybe the timelines are a bit extended, it's about hunkering down at the moment. I think you want to make sure that people understand the fundamentals of your technology, but it's not the type of market environment to be trying to create a tremendous amount of interest where there's just a prioritization that's going on within the buy side to nearer term value inflection points as everybody tries to tries to produce a return in a really complicated market backdrop. So for those types of companies, maybe it does argue for sitting on the sidelines a little bit, at least as it relates to some of the more traditional biotech capital providers. There's a whole nother set of capital providers, though, that could be accessed. You think about some of the really interesting companies that have become public over the last couple of IPO cohorts, and there's different types of buyers, whether it be technology investors or geographically diverse investors, where that does represent a pool of capital to at the right time start to engage. So for the ones where maybe there's a timeline dynamic where the catalyst is a little bit outside of what the investable, the current investable dynamic is, whatever that means on any given day of the week, I would think about kind of different pools of capital that would make sense to engage over time and educating them in the right way. For those that have nearer term catalysts, level setting expectations is everything at the moment. And I fully appreciate that that's a uncomfortable position for some management teams to be in around how do you actually define for investors and for KOLs and others that will be speaking about your data, what clinical success looks like. And so whether it's a response rate hurdle or some other metric, I think having some real internal discovery around what that communication strategy looks like is something that has to be very well thought out, because it's clearly a market environment that's sensitive to any type of data release at the moment. And you've got to make sure that you've got aligned parties and a framework of thinking that ultimately gives people the scorecard that they need to judge success, failure, or something in between when you have your data set.
So final one. Back to I'm CEO, but instead of a public company, I'm CEO of a private company. I did a crossover round last year. I'm looking at my capital position. My crossover investors, lightly, possibly had hoped that I would IPO within a sort of 6 to 9 month time frame, and that's the sort of backing that they had. They kind of put into me. What am I thinking? Like, what am I thinking about for an IPO standpoint? And what is the mentality for that first company that kind of just dives in? It's a bit, you feel a bit like Columbus, right? You kind of start on the journey. You're really, it's kind of the first person. You hit America, you're like, woohoo, it's success. Or you get eaten by the cannibals, right? So you kind of sit there and say, do I do it? Do I not do it? And none of us really remember, maybe you do, but I certainly don't remember of the cycles I've lived through, who that first brave, intrepid management team actually was that actually tested the market and showed that there was actually resilience in the market and we were actually good to go.
Yeah, no, it is obviously an important decision, particularly for the first mover. And I'd argue, and we do it, sometimes we debate this, from the capital market seat, if you can be the first mover, perhaps there's a benefit to going out when the market's really, really challenged. If you get a lot of attention and clearly if you can raise capital in that environment, there's some intrinsic benefit to being viewed as an outlier in that regard, to positive, so long as it's positive. And that's the really hard part to assess, whether or not you've got line of sight towards a positive outcome that sets you off in the direction that you need to be set in to deliver on whatever it is the positioning or anchoring point of the story ultimately is. I think there's blocking and tackling that is not too dissimilar from what underpinned the success stories of the last decade plus of IPO activity that we've seen within biotech that's going to be required for whoever the first mover is. Clearly, you need to have existing investor support. I don't think you want to effectively walk into an IPO market without that support, which is very consistent with what caused the IPO market to be so accommodative over the last handful of years here, was that existing investor interest for different reasons, because obviously IPOs were working really well. But for the other reason right now, if there may not be a lot of external support for an IPO, you probably need that strong base. But the other dynamic to think through, though, is how do you curate a list of, I'm not sure if the number is 2, 3, 4, or 5, but additional external capital providers that prefer the public market liquidity, prefer you to be public, and cultivating that relationship and to your best of your ability, getting line of sight towards an order conversion from that new fresh capital that's going to help validate you on your public market journey is incredibly important, given just the volatility in the broad market. So I don't think there's a silver bullet answer, honestly, but it's just the blocking and tackling of cultivating relationships with both the existings and making sure that they're there for that support, and then finding and spending the time with and trying to generate that early order conversion from the new investor category that can help bridge your way into the public markets.
But on that, you know, when I set the valuation of my mezz financing, I looked at my public market comps, looked at the EVs, you know, that were arguably, you know, double in value to what they are today and plus, right? So looked at their EVs and effectively turned around and said, they went out, did their IPO at, you know, a dollar. If I think about a standard, you know, 2x, yeah. 1.5 to 2x, you know, on my post for the mezz, I should be valuing myself somewhere at sort of, I don't know, 50 cents to 75 cents. Now I'm in a situation where my comp was a dollar, whatever, 2 years ago, 18 months ago, it's now at 50 cents and arguably for a lot of them below. What do I do now from a valuation standpoint? You've got to be having those conversations. I mean,
yeah,
those conversations have got to be taking place. What do I actually do now? Because I've got this disconnect, massive now disconnect between my private valuation and my public market comps.
Yeah, I think that the whole down round and whether or not it's something that has, it can overwhelm the IPO conversation with an investor because they somehow think that that's going to command such attention and send such a signal about a company because you have to go with a down round. I think that gets far too much airtime amongst IPO market practitioners, whether it's boards, companies, bankers, et cetera. It's honestly, in a market that's corrected like the way that we have, the starting point of the conversation is probably a down round, right? That's the appropriate way to think about just corporate finance. If you know, depending on what fundamental progress the company has made, the alternative in the public market has gotten exceptionally more inexpensive, and so you have to react to that reality. If the objective is to have an up round in the near term, the candid advice is probably it's just not the type of IPO story that would work in the current market. Now that said, assuming that there hasn't been fundamental progress for a company between their private financing and their public, and that's where kind of the art evaluation comes in. If there has been that fundamental progress, you need the meaningful fundamental progress, then of course you can talk about what an up round looks like. But the starting point for the conversation right now is flat to down round if you want to test the market in the near term. Frankly, most companies aren't testing the market. So there have been so many that were so well capitalized as a private company that you can kind of sit out for at least the next quarter or two and wait for things to stabilize.
And dusting off your crystal ball, do you think the next quarter or two we'll see that resurgence of interest and that we'll see some sort of recovery taking place in the market?
I think we'll see it on the secondary side before we see it on the IPO side, which is just the natural evolution of these periods of time that come out of this location. Today's a good, I think, an interesting day actually for that prediction or that claim. There's been four follow-ons announced just today, which is more than there has been probably in the last month. I haven't checked the stats, but that sounds and feels about right. So I think we'll see it on the secondary side, which will then translate into IPO product. IPOs are always viewed as really interesting vehicles to invest in coming out of these periods of dislocation because they're theoretically should be that natural source of alpha, and alpha is really hard to come by in a market that's more discerning or maybe has a negative bias. So once we do start to see that stabilization, which I think will be led by the secondary side before the primary issuing side, we'll hopefully see the foundation being laid for Q4 and Q1 activity on the IPO in the IPO market. So there's my prediction, Ness. You'll have it. You can hold me to it. Q4, Q1, we'll see some more biotech IPOs. But until then, let's do the secondary market.
Okay, so this is great. You know, we're going to see a flood in Q4 or Q1 at these outside valuations, you know, multiples on the post from the mezz rounds that were done.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like there are you know, podcasts where it feels it's a little depressing, right? And I gotta tell you, this is one of those. You know, we gotta finish like it's a state of the markets. I mean, you look at the inflation rate, you know, you're looking at the consumer price index. It feels like a brutal week. And every week I think it's a brutal week, and then the next week comes along and it's more brutal. You know, it's like that one about you're just not flogging hard enough. We got to finish on a positive note here. Tell me something positive. You got to give me something.
All right. That back to positives. I think that we're going to see out of this period of dislocation where we've got more eyeballs on the sector than we've ever seen, we're going to see a complete resurgence in the types of financings that happen, the form of those financings, just the creativity on the capital market side will keep up with the creativity that we've seen in kind of the new technology and development side on biotech. So coming out of this, we're going to be more well equipped to deal with any other macro period of volatility that we see, which I'm looking forward to because it keeps my job interesting. Hopefully that's positive.
I'll
enough,
take it. You know,
that's what you're going to get out of me today.
I will take it. Market coming back in Q4, Q1 of next year, and we're going to see strong capital markets for the sector. So this is good. John, thank you. This has been fascinating. Hopefully the next time you and I talk, it will be far more upbeat about a market really that we're starting to see really moving into bull territory, or actually in bull territory again, with investor sentiment really being very positive about the sector and the macros, frankly, also. Thank you so much for your time. Great to speak to you.
Thanks so much, Ness. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Between the Biotech Waves.